Welcome to Happy Healthy Unalaska. This is Emlyn Crane, and I am here with Sarah Melke, who is with Soraya, and she's been in town this week doing some training with our first responders and other community agencies. Sarah, can you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you were doing here in town this week?
Yeah, I'm Sarah Melke, as you said. I have been in emergency services for about 15 years now and came from that background and then went through a whole bunch of stuff as well that made me very passionate about mental health issues, which are extremely common in first responders, namely PTSD. And while I was working on my degree program, I came up with an idea that turned into a paper, that turned into a 90-minute training program, that turned into a two-day training program.
Wow.
I ended up with a Bachelor's of Science in Paramedicine and a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology while I was working on this program. So I came up with a program that is based out of my personal experience. It's based out of a lot of research, and it's based out of a lot of solid academic basis.
Great. And the training you did this week was for mostly first responders?
Yes.
Okay. And let's just start out talking about what is post-traumatic stress disorder. We hear the phrase PTSD thrown around a lot. What is it actually?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a group of symptoms that is common after trauma. And trauma is going to be something that swamps your ability to cope and throws you off course. And what it happens is it causes a series of changes in behavior and thinking, as well as in the brain itself, that begins to manifest over a longer period of time. PTSD is going to kick in after about 30 days of this. It has to have been going on for 30 days.
And what are some of the symptoms of PTSD, the physical or emotional symptoms? And how can we look for it in ourselves or in others that we know have experienced trauma or that deal with trauma on a daily basis, like a medical provider or a first responder?
Absolutely. We used to believe that PTSD was more of an acute phase that came from one single event, but we now understand that it's also cumulative.
Okay.
And so we're seeing that a lot in first responders and the military as well, who have repeated exposures to traumatic events. And so what happens with PTSD is there's four groups of symptoms. There's intrusion symptoms, which is your nightmares and flashbacks, and a memory causing intense emotional reaction or physical reaction, which isn't normal. There's avoidance symptoms, that you start avoiding certain thoughts and feelings or certain places and people. The third one is changes in thinking or mood, that you start having problems just feeling. You can't feel positive emotion or even any emotion sometimes, or maybe some amnesias. You start having, you know, it starts changing your belief about yourself and the world. You start withdrawing and detaching. And then that last symptom cluster is that you become more reactive. You're starting to have problems with sleep, problems relaxing. You're very hypervigilant. You're kind of always alert, very jumpy and easily startled, and having trouble concentrating. And so you've got these four symptom clusters after an event, and it's been going on for more than a month. It's causing you some problems with your functioning, with your relationships, and it's not from, you know, a medication or a medical condition. Now, one of the worst parts of PTSD is it actually will start to interfere with your ability to get help. And so the more this goes on, the harder it gets to raise your hand and say, I need some help with this because I'm not functioning.
I would think that's especially true for folks that are maybe in the military or in law enforcement, because we, you know, they are trained to be so self-reliant, so strong, and, you know, have the ability to deal with anything, that that must be very difficult to reach out for help.
It is. It is. And we are very much a sort of a macho profession in fire, EMS, law enforcement. We're tough. We have to be. And so when we are faced with something like this and you cannot control your own brain, you cannot control your own thoughts, your own emotions, the first thing we're going to think is, oh, it's weakness. And we see that a lot. Oh, they must not be cut out for this, or they must not be made for this. But what we know now about PTSD, thanks to the research of a lot of dedicated people, is that getting exposed to something traumatic actually changes and rewires your brain and your nervous system. And that accounts for all of these symptoms. There's that big there's a big thick book in psychology called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
DSM, yep.
It's got all the good stuff in it. The stress disorders are the only disorders in the entire book that have an event as part of the diagnostic criteria. This is something that happens to you. This has nothing to do with strength or weakness. This has to do with this is what happens to human beings who are exposed to unusual things. And it changes your brain and nervous system, and you have symptoms, and it is absolutely, completely unrelated to being strong, weak, not cut out for this, etc.
Wow. Okay. Do you think the term PTSD is used too indiscriminately these days? It seems like I hear it a lot, and maybe sometimes people throw it around too casually.
I do want to differentiate. I don't think it's overdiagnosed because it is very specific to a set of diagnostic criteria. However, it probably is somewhat overused. I think a lot of people just kind of have some assumptions about it.
Mm-hmm.
One of which is time delineated, that this has to be going on for more than 30 days. And so very often you'll have someone go through a traumatic event and they'll say, oh, I have PTSD in the days and weeks after. You may start having the symptoms of PTSD, but it's not qualified as PTSD until it's been going on for a very long 30 days. I think there's a lot of misconceptions as well about the symptoms, and that there are those four very specific symptom clusters that we talked about. The diagnostic criteria are fairly clear, and so I think that a lot of us don't know what those diagnostic criteria are.
Okay.
Because trauma is going to change you.
Sure.
Trauma is going to change the way you look at yourself, the way you look at other humans, and the way you look at the world.
Absolutely.
And that may or may not be the same as the four symptom clusters that we talked about.
Okay. So you kind of talked about this being a diagnosable mental health issue. Does that mean that if someone is diagnosed with PTSD, would their treatment be covered by insurance?
It generally is. And we already know that we owe a tremendous amount to our military service members. This is yet another area that we have a tremendous debt to them, because it's because of especially the Vietnam generation that we have a clear understanding of PTSD, that we talk about PTSD, that we know what to do for PTSD. There's been so much research trying to support those who've gone through combat and who've gone through the military that we do know how to fix this. We know what happens. We have a very good idea, a very clear idea of what happens in PTSD and therefore what to do about it. And so it's definitely something that's very treatable, and there are some very common treatments for it. As to whether it's qualified under insurance as a medical condition or a mental health disorder, I'm not sure. I think it probably depends on the insurance, but we do know that it is both.
Okay.
That there are psychological changes, but they're very much based in changes to the body, to the brain itself.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow, that's so interesting. And what are some of the ways that PTSD can be treated?
The frontline treatments for PTSD are to talk about it and also medication. And then there's this awesome new thing called EMDR that's actually not new. It's been around for a while, but it's finally getting the attention it deserves.
Oh, I've heard of that. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So what happens, it's crucial to talk about the trauma, because trauma causes changes in the brain that also make it difficult to put words around what happened. So talking to a mental health professional is absolutely crucial and key. And they can help you to see the things that you are believing about what happened that are not accurate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole set of distortions that go with trauma that are very classic. Medication has a definite place in treating this.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain neurotransmitters, namely serotonin, that have a lot to do with your fear networks and calming down the fear centers in the brain. And they get drained by trying to deal with this trauma. So
okay.
Very often you'll see an antidepressant that is going to be prescribed for this. And then EMDR, which sounds like voodoo magic, and it's simply using the body to affect the brain. It's using the body's systems, and you talk about or process the trauma while following a light back and forth with your eyes, or even listening to a sound that goes back and forth between ears. It has to do with crossing the midline of the brain. It gets all both halves involved, and it somehow gives you the distance to be able to talk about and process that memory that's been stuck in your inbox for way too long. And there's no hypnosis involved. There's no drugs involved. It's very simply, it's related to REM sleep, in fact, because you see the eye movement. Uh-huh. And it's the same kind of thing where your brain is consolidating memories and finding all these little connections so that you have a nice, neat memory. And in trauma, you don't have nice, neat memories. You have a bunch of shrapnel. And so EMDR goes through and helps you find all those little shrapnels, which become triggers, and put them back together so that your brain can process it and it can become a normal memory, not this catastrophic thing that is taking up all your brain and emotional resources.
That is really interesting. I've never heard it explained that way before.
Yeah. EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing.
Okay.
It was something Francine Shapiro, a psychologist, came up with this in 1987. And so this has been around for a while, but it's just now finally starting to catch on because it's very, very effective in treating traumatic memories.
Okay. So what happens when someone can't or isn't able or doesn't or isn't able to access treatment? How does it impact someone to have PTSD long term? What kind of impact does it have on their life and their health? And
the neurologists have a cool little saying, the neurons that fire together wire together. And what that generally ends up meaning is that as the brain changes after trauma, the more you have that habit build up, it starts to wear a reaction path in the brain. So kind of like building a sled run, and you start to wear this path and it becomes a habit of how you react, whether it's the inability to feel or the hyperreactive, jumpy, startle reflex, that becomes a habit and it starts to become ingrained. And the more it becomes ingrained, like any habit, the harder it becomes to unlearn it. Mm. And PTSD, one of the areas that it messes with, is the part of your brain that's responsible for unlearning this stuff. It's absolutely crucial to work with a professional because this is very much past something that we can deal with on our own. We cannot pull ourselves up with our own bootstraps on this one, not even first responders, and we're good at that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is it starts to become a habit. It starts to eat away at your quality of life. You start believing a lot of distortions that aren't true because your brain is running out of resources, so it's going to start taking shortcuts. If you think about voting when you're extremely busy and you don't have time to research the issues and try to figure out who believes what, you start looking at, okay, what are my friends and family doing? And you start going with the defaults. And what is the majority doing? That's what your brain starts doing when it's running out of resources. It's going to start taking shortcuts to try to conserve what's left. And it tends to be kind of the more negative shortcuts because your brain is survival based and it's looking out for the worst case scenario. So things start looking much darker than they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reason that PTSD is so closely correlated, so closely connected to suicide.
Mm-hmm.
PTSD increases your chances of suicide by 5 to 7 times. It's very significant because the depression and the anxiety that come with PTSD are so hard to live with.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. And very often we pick up a substance abuse disorder. We very often turn to alcohol, which is exactly the opposite of what we need because it's going to narrow your focus even more. It is a depressant. I'm a poster child for this. I have been dealing with complex PTSD for almost 20 years. And it took me 11 years to tell my story. And so by the time I got to telling somebody what had happened, I had lost over a decade of my life. I had lost a marriage and my life had turned into total chaos.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a poster child for don't do this because I know the cost it takes to not deal with this stuff.
Okay. Can you tell me, is there a difference between PTSD and complex PTSD? I was going to ask you that and now you've mentioned it. So
there is a difference between complex PTSD and PTSD. I don't know that it is quantified yet and put in writing. There are several articles out there. It often has to do with things that happen in childhood, that it becomes harder to process those things. They become harder to reach. But again, it has become a habit and it's become ingrained. And like any habit, that gets much harder to unlearn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think most people associate PTSD with military service. What are some other professions or experiences or situations that can cause PTSD?
The psychology book, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, just went through its fifth revision, and there's actually a new criteria for being exposed to trauma, which is repeated or extreme exposure, usually in the course of professional duties. And that's pretty much for us in first response. That's law enforcement, that's fire, that's EMS, that's going to be those that work with people in crisis of any sort, because we are regularly exposed to things that some people don't even know exist.
Sure.
Some of the worst of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so any of those professions that are going to go out into working with people in crisis have the ability to be exposed. It's kind of like secondhand smoke at some point.
Right.
Where there are some things that are so catastrophic that just witnessing it and trying to help out, and often not being able to, are so hard on us. And they become, your trauma becomes my trauma.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't process it and deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yes, you also definitely do see PTSD from a civilian perspective as well. After an assault, after a robbery, perhaps even after like a home invasion, after domestic violence, mm-hmm. and after a disaster. These are all things that can cause PTSD in a civilian.
A fire or a natural
Absolutely.
Disaster. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
For folks, and we know there are so many who experience domestic violence, child abuse, or sexual assault. Does the kind of PTSD they experience, is it different from the kind you're talking about that's more of a professional, related to a profession such as being a soldier or a first responder?
No, it's entirely the same thing. It's the same set of diagnostic clusters. It's the same set of symptoms. The way I like to put it in my classes, it's the same freeway. There's a lot of different on-ramps. And it also is going to maybe look a little bit different
mm-hmm.
in a soldier or a firefighter who's used to putting on a certain face than it's going to be in somebody who is maybe more openly able to show emotion. It's going to look a little bit different in various people. It's going to look a little bit different in a child versus an adult, a man versus a woman perhaps. But it's the same set of symptoms. It's the mm-hmm. same diagnostics all across the board.
I've heard that the more time that passes after a damaging incident without a person processing the event, longer it takes to, quote, get over, unquote, it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, because I have lived it for a very long time. We talked a little bit about the habits and how this becomes a habit. But another piece of that is that when the body can't process something, whether it's a piece of tuberculosis bacteria or a bullet fragment, it builds a wall around it, a wall of cells to protect itself from this thing. And these traumatic memories, I've heard professionals call them pathogenic secrets.
Mm.
And that's exactly what they become, is that it gets walled off in your brain and it gets harder to get at. Again, PTSD is extremely treatable. We know what to do for this. But over time, it does become harder and harder to get to, because these habits wear themselves in, and more so, these habits, as you withdraw, as you become more hyper-aware and hyper-vigilant, people start withdrawing from you. People mm-hmm. start walking away, and the more those relationships disappear from your life, the more in danger you become.
The more isolated you
exactly.
are. Exactly.
Yeah. And so it really spirals, and then perhaps that, if you haven't already, that is where you start picking up the substances and the various ways of trying to cope, and your quality of life just really snowballs.
How could I best help someone that I believe may be suffering with PTSD?
Obviously, the first step is always noticing. And so if you suspect that this might be going on with somebody, doing the research and looking into what those symptoms look like, and then going to them and saying, you know what, this is what I've been noticing. You've changed. And when you're confronting somebody, you hold the burden of proof. So if you see something on social media, for example, it's very easy for them to delete it. If you see something on social media that worries you, take a screenshot of it or take a picture and go to them and say, this is what I've heard you say. This is what I've seen on social media. This is what you said in this text message. I'm concerned that this might be the problem. And just saying, you've changed, and this is what I think is going on. Let's get you some help. How can I help you Is there anything you want to talk about, that kind of sort of thing?
Okay.
And get them to somebody with a higher level of care.
Right.
All we do in first responders is we show up and we get a scene calmed down and get the scene stabilized, and then we get the patient to a higher level of care.
Next level.
And that's all you have to do as a friend or family member,
mm-hmm.
is stabilize the scene, get them to a higher level of care, offer to go with them, make sure
make the
that
phone
you
call
have
for them,
absolutely,
whatever.
And just let them know that, hey, we are going to get through this. And you may have been alone up to this point, but I know now. And the cavalry is here. We're going to get you through this. You're not facing this alone anymore.
Yes. And other people go through this, and you can.
Absolutely.
You can feel better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There is life on the other side, and it's actually better in a lot of ways than it was before the trauma.
You can feel better.
You can.
Maybe not every day, maybe not all day, but you can feel better more of the time.
Yep. And it might take a little bit.
Yep.
The mind doesn't heal instantly or quickly, especially mm-hmm. if it's been taking a while to get you to this point.
Mm-hmm.
But you will get better.
Okay.
There is hope. There's tremendous hope.
And I just want to go back for a moment to when you were talking about types of treatment. And you did mention medication. And I know some people really struggle with the idea of taking medication at all, or the thought that they might have to take medication forever. From your research and what you know, do most people end up staying on medication forever, or is it sometimes a short-term medication, or is it just varies person to person?
It varies considerably.
Okay.
It varies by the situation. I know that in my case, because it had been going on for so long,
mm-hmm.
the neurotransmitters and probably the cell receptors and all of that got changed,
mm-hmm.
and so it took a lot longer. On the fire ground, when we have a fire burning in a particular part of a house, we will very often cut a hole in the roof above the fire. And that's going to give us a window of clarity. It's going to draw the smoke and the poisonous gases up away from the fire so that the attack team can see the seat of the fire finally instead of all the smoke, and go in and take out the seat of the fire. This is very much what medication does,
okay.
is it gives you the clarity. It's not going to fix the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to clear it up so that you can see clearly, and mm-hmm. in some cases even want to get help,
mm-hmm.
and enable you to get the help that you need. But you have to take care of the underlying issue, or it's just going to keep coming back. And yes, some people might have to be on it for a longer period of time,
mm-hmm.
because of changes in the body or brain.
Sure.
But fortunately, we have professionals who are a lot smarter with that stuff than I am, and
sure.
able to figure out when that needs to happen.
And it's like if you were to develop diabetes,
exactly.
which is a change in your body chemistry. I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I can't say. But, you know, then you take a medication that's going to help you get back to where your balance is supposed to be.
Exactly.
And it's the same thing when you're dealing with your brain.
Yeah. Some people's bodies do not make insulin. They
mm-hmm.
have to take shots of insulin.
Mm-hmm.
Some people's bodies make insulin, but it's not as effective, or it's not enough. So
mm-hmm.
they have to supplement it.
Right.
Or they take a medication to manage their blood sugar a different way. This is the same thing.
Right.
It has to do with the neurotransmitters in your brain instead of the sugar in your blood.
Mm-hmm.
Same basic principle.
Great. And I'm thinking that, you know, for someone who's been suffering with PTSD, maybe taking medication, at least in the short term, will allow them to even just simply catch up on their sleep, get a good night's sleep, and start to feel rested and able to look up and around when maybe up until
exactly.
that point they've been sort of looking down and... Yeah, it sounds exhausting.
Precisely. At that point, your quality of life suffers so much
mm-hmm.
that having a medication, even if you're resistant to the idea, is going to help you tremendously. It's going to help you manage those symptoms and make your life livable again, and even possibly bring some joy back into your life so that you can function.
Yes.
You can, your family can have you back. You can have your family back. You can have your feelings back, and you can get some help.
So what do you think are some misconceptions about PTSD, or what do you wish people understood better about PTSD?
The biggest one that is a problem for us as first responders as well is that a lot of us think it is just a military problem. Combat is how it was really discovered. This goes back to the ancient Egyptians. Homer talked about it. Shakespeare talked about it. This is not a new problem. Combat is how we kind of discovered or learned about PTSD.
We called it shell shock.
We called it shell shock. We called it soldier's heart in the Civil War. We called it a combat stress reaction in World War II. This is not a new problem, but it applies to anybody who faces a traumatic event. It's mm-hmm. part of humanity. It's not part of combat. Mm-hmm. Another big one, the one that very often kills us, is that you think you can do it alone. Mm-hmm. PTSD, depression, anxiety, they cause you to withdraw from people. We're kind of like animals in that we withdraw when we're hurting, and that can kill. Social support is absolutely crucial. You mm-hmm. have to stay connected. You have to maintain those relationships. You cannot do this alone. Trust me, as a survivor, I have tried for a very long time, and it does not go well for you. Mm-hmm. And that's part of where that dramatic increase in suicide comes from.
So it seems like for law enforcement, EMTs, anybody who's dealing with people in crisis or, you know, major human trauma, they may feel like they can't process their workday the same way that other people do in other professions. You can go home and talk about how the printer jammed, or, you know, your staff is driving you crazy, or,
yes.
you know, you got to work overtime. But when you're a law enforcement officer who's dealing with, you know, perhaps having to recover a body of a loved one, or, you know, a community member, or an EMT who's had to deal with a very gruesome scene, you not only want to be respectful of the people that you were working with, you don't want to go home and talk about them and betray their privacy, but also you don't want to put that on your family. Mm-hmm. So if I can see how that could, you could just sort of clam up
yes.
and just not talk about anything.
Yes.
And then, like you say, you wear that groove in your brain where you just hold everything in, and you just become paralyzed and don't talk about anything.
Yeah, the only ones that you can really talk about the incident with is those who were there that day.
Sure.
And even then, we very often don't talk about it with one another, because it seems like it's weakness to admit that it's bothering us. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, everybody who was on that call is struggling with the same images, and they're struggling with the same things from that call, and we all kind of suffer alongside, thinking we're the only ones, because mm-hmm. we don't talk about it. And it takes a tremendous risk to talk about it. You have to really know and trust your crew members. But yeah, you cannot talk about it with the non-emergency personnel sure. that were there. You can still talk about some of the feelings that you're dealing with.
Right.
And that's the key part. You have to find a way to share your life with your spouse or partner, with close friends. You cannot talk about the specifics of the call,
right.
maybe,
right.
but you can still talk about the aftermath. And that is absolutely crucial. And if you have access to a trained professional, you've got to be able to take advantage of that resource, because, again, this is so far beyond our ability to just fix ourselves.
Right. And we're very lucky that we have great behavioral health providers
yes.
here in town. And, yeah, I mean, I often think that many of the world's problems would be solved or would be lessened if we allowed people, but men in particular, to express emotions other than, you know, anger or lust. You know, I think
yeah.
we need to make it okay for all men, but especially our first responders and soldiers, to express, you know, sadness and
yes.
depression and helplessness and all the feelings that are a normal part of the human experience.
At the least, we need to be able to express it to one another.
Yes.
Because even if we can't show it to the public, it has to come out somewhere.
Right.
Because otherwise it just stays internal and it starts to bubble and it becomes almost acidic, and it just eats away at your character. It eats away at your spirit. It eats away at your entire mindset mm-hmm. of the world and of yourself. The other misconceptions that I really wish that people understood was that depression, anxiety, PTSD, this stuff does warp your perspective in a fairly mm-hmm. predictable way. If you look into the cognitive distortions that go with this stuff, what you're seeing is not necessarily accurate. You can be 100% convinced that the way you're seeing the world is accurate and everyone else is deluded, but you're wrong. It's not nearly as bad as it looks. This is a predictable set of shortcuts that your brain takes. Mm-hmm. The other big piece is, when you've gone through trauma, one of your biggest fears is that you'll never be the same again. And that is, there is some truth to that. You aren't going to be the same again. But what you don't see is that you can come out better and stronger. There is, I don't speak Japanese, so I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation, but there's this concept called kintsukuroi.
Strong at the broken places.
It's strong at the broken places, but it's more than that. So they take a piece of pottery that's been broken and they put it back together, but they use gold and silver lacquer. And so this thing that has been broken and is apparently now not going to be good for anything but to be thrown away is now not only whole again, but it is better and it is more beautiful and it is more unique. It has a story. It has survived being broken. And for me, that is the best picture of life after trauma, that you come out of it better and stronger and, yes, more beautiful.
Yeah, and you radiate more light. Like what you've done is taken what you've gone through and now you're going out and impacting all these other people and making a difference for them. You're now able to take that and benefit other people, and that's amazing.
The only a cracked pot is going to be able to radiate light through it.
Well, Sarah, this has been absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate you agreeing to do Happy Healthy on Alaska. Is there anything else you'd like to cover before we close?
I've been teaching this course all around the country. This is my 21st class, and I've seen a lot of different systems. I've seen a lot of different situations, and what you have here is tremendous. You have a lot of support. You have the behavioral health specialists from APIA. You have USAFE. You have IFHS. You have a police department and a fire department that are committed to working together and working for you. You have Unicy and Icicle have their own set of safety and behavioral health people. There's a tremendous amount of support here. Mm-hmm. It's there. You just have to reach out and take it. And especially after trauma, there's this thing that kicks in called survivor guilt, and you don't think you're worth saving. That's another one that's not true. You mm-hmm. are worth saving. There yes. is help out there, and all you need to do is reach for it. You have a tremendous asset here in Unalaska, and it's been quite incredible to witness that.
Great. That's good to hear. We are very appreciative of our first responders, especially. Great. Well, thank you, Sarah Melke. It's been a fascinating conversation. And
thank you for having me.
Happy Healthy Unalaska is a collaborative project between KUCB and USAFE. Thanks for listening, and have a good day.